It's so lovely to see you, Elsa. I've been kind of looking through and doing a little bit research on you. You have a tremendous profession and a noble profession working with the UN. And I just think I see you do some amazing stuff. And I was so looking forward to talking to you today. So thank you for accepting my invitation to be on my podcast. I'm privileged to talk to you. Thank you.
Of course. And I am the same, dear Angelina, okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Because I know you are amazing.
Well, thank you so much. So, yeah, let's give a little context. We'll start with you introducing yourself and talking a little bit about your journey. Like, how did you become interested in human rights? Because that's a focal point in your profession and your legacy moving forward is this human rights component.
Yes. Thank you, Angelina. So my name is Elsa Stamatopoulou. I am from Greece. I did my degree in law in Greece and then did graduate studies abroad in the United States in criminal justice and then in Switzerland in international law, international relations and international law. And I started working at the United Nations in 1979, and I moved immediately after 9 months to the Human Rights Office in Geneva. And basically, I have spent most of my life working on human rights at the UN, at the international level. And the last 7, 8 years were extremely and totally focused and only focused on indigenous issues. Indigenous people's rights, but my work on Indigenous people's rights has been back since 1981, when I had the good luck as a new young person in human rights to meet, you know, the first ever person to work on Indigenous rights, and he became my mentor. And his name was Augusta Williamson Diaz. He was, of course, he has passed on now. He was a political refugee from Guatemala, but our visionary head of our human rights office at that time had hired him. And it was Augusto that became, that opened that door. Because, you know, you need a tango, you know?
Yeah.
You need the movement that was pushing to open that door and somebody that opens the little crack and makes it bigger and bigger. And then, you know, and I had this, the luck, you know, if you like it, I was very lucky to see the indigenous movement coming to the international arena early on and to experience with them the way they internationalized their issues, you know. Basically, I became like their sister, like many others, because the solidarity movement has been going on at the same time. Now, why I was interested in human rights, you know, for me, human rights were not just something that I took courses on in law school and in international law when I went to Geneva, but it was the fact that we had a dictatorship in Greece when I was still in high school. We had a dictatorship in 1967, you know? And so it is a lived experience, the lack of democracy. And it was my generation, actually, who were university students at the time of the breakout of this dictatorship that fought a lot together with the rest of the people. But leadership was exercised by young people, you know? And that really formed me, my soul and spirit. And, you know, then you put this together with what you learn at university, whatever is your study topic, you know. And I believe very much in human rights, Angelina, because human rights is about, you know, resistance to systems that are imposed on us. Right, resistance, and then, if possible, you know, strategic moves and actions so that we can bend and change our lives as human beings. So I really believe in that, because it is critical mind, right? The critique, right? It's norms that we put forward to critique the state that does these things to us, and actions. And I believe in that very much. And I saw indigenous peoples doing that.
Yeah.
You know, Angelina, it was for me, I mean, to see the strategic thinking of the movement that became an international movement in the 1970s.
Yes.
Because, of course, there were many national and local movements throughout. I mean, indigenous peoples have been resisting colonization and marginalization, of course. But what happened, and it is beautiful in the indigenous movement, one of the beauties is that, you know, in the 1970s, all these national, local said, hey, let's now come to international level. And 1977 was a critical moment at that moment, you know? And they got together in Geneva, and Augusto Williamson Diaz was one of them that opened the crack, and others also helped. And it was through the anti-racism agenda. But anti-racism was one of the, you know, of the ideologies, if you like, that was that they were embracing and that was embracing them. So anti-racism, anti-colonialism, human rights, and social justice struggles. You know, so all these were tremendous inspiring ideological movements of those beautiful times, you know?
Yeah.
And the indigenous peoples. But, you know, may I say something very important, because now it's 2024.
Yeah.
And 100 years ago, something happened that had an importance for indigenous peoples internationally. And actually, it was Chief Descahe of the Haudenosaunee, living on the Canadian side, you know. And in 1923, he went to Geneva, to the League of Nations, to advocate the cause of his people, you know. And he wrote a letter saying that I am the only international representative of the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations, and I came here, and he was complaining against Canada. And he was not received. For a whole year he waited until 2024. And he was not received, and then came back, and he came to this side, to the US side of the territory, you know, and he gave this historic speech over the radio, which we like to quote a lot. And he said, I am the representative of the Six Nations. And then he said, I went there and they didn't receive me. They have free speech in Little Switzerland, he said. I went there to plead the cause of my people, you know, to stay on their own lands, to believe their own systems, and to be in dignity. And I mentioned this because last year, but now it's 2024, since actually he died also in 1924. Last year in the summer, there were big ceremonies that took place in Geneva to mark Descahes. His name on the in the books of Canada was Levy General, you know, to mark that historic event. And of course, indigenous peoples said, hey, he came then, and still at the Human Rights Council of the UN, still we cannot speak. I mean, indigenous peoples can speak elsewhere, of course.
And yeah.
It's one of the main things I want to stress here, but not at the Human Rights Council, which, because the Human Rights Nest has been the one where they opened that door big, they thrived, you know, and they achieved a lot, indigenous peoples did. But still, the highest human rights body of the UN Human Rights Council, is not accepting them to speak as indigenous peoples.
Right. It's kind of ironic.
Exactly. So that's why they put that forward so big, you know?
Yes.
It's in Geneva. Well done, you know.
Mm.
Beautiful, beautiful. I was not there, but I have seen many photographs of what they did and speeches that they were done. Amazing. And we always mention Angelina Chief Descahe because he became, you know, it's a thread of indigenous history that we don't want to lose. We want to continue feeding to it. Because one of the things he said, if I, in that speech before he died, he said, if I have died or I'm unable in the future, make sure to continue this,
yeah.
He said, to pass on this story. So as soon as I established with my colleagues the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in the year 2003, on our website, we put Descahe's photograph that we found on the in the archives of the municipality of Geneva,
yeah.
Plus this story that I was telling you, you know?
Yeah.
And it was also a Maori religious leader, Ratana, who came a year later, 2024. And this is very important for us to tell the story because, first, not to lose the story, the thread of history and the strength of the movement, but also to underline how indigenous peoples always saw themselves as having a sovereign to sovereign, you know, nation to nation relationship with states. And that's why they went to the League of Nations.
Yeah.
And of course, later to the United Nations.
Yeah, absolutely. That is so important, that tie-in historically and how it all began. And this creates a really good part, segue to talk about the doctrine of discovery.
Yes. Well, from the very beginning when indigenous peoples, even from 1977, but especially from 1982 onwards, when the first indigenous rights related body was created. Its name was UN Working Group on Indigenous Populations. So indigenous peoples, and I attended that. I'm an elder now. And people came and they were talking about colonization and they were talking about the so-called discovery and, you know, critiquing and so on. And later on, the doctrine of discovery became a much bigger, you know, point, one of the great points of critique together with colonialism that indigenous peoples put to the international level. And the fantastic study was done by our Onondaga sister and member of the Permanent Forum, Tania Gonella Frischner, on the doctrine of discovery. And she found that it is not just a North American phenomenon, of course, but in different expressions, you can find it around the world. You know, the doctrine of discovery, which has various reverberations, you know. It means, for instance, the first thing it means is that the Europeans, right, the first concept of the doctrine of discovery, the first European country that will discover a land before any other European country has priority to occupy it, to exploit it, and so on. And unfortunately, the Vatican in the 15th century, through a papal bull, endorsed this idea and gave, you know, sacredness, so to speak, you know, with this idea. And the indigenous peoples have critiqued it strongly. And when we had in 1992, it was the 100th anniversary. Indigenous peoples, especially from this country, they were very strong, maybe also Canadians, actually, together they were trying to get the Pope, the Vatican, to annul the papal bull. Mm-hmm. The Vatican has not formally done that, but their representatives at times say that this is invalid, it's not valid, but they refuse or resist, you know, to say, mm-hmm. oh, now we expel this from any doctrine we ever emitted, you know. But also the doctrine of discovery has had an impact, you know, on land rights, for example. It is, as our indigenous leaders have said, they considered that we could not own our land, you know, the colonialists, but we could use it. We could use land like the animals and the plants use land, but we didn't have the legal capacity, meaning, you know, because we were heathens, right? And to own land. And I have read some good, you know, literature research about how, for example, in the U.S. Constitution, you don't find the issue of indigenous lands, and you just find a reference to indigenous peoples, you know, through some articles on commerce. So, you know, this how can I say, a certain invisibility that is imposed by the colonial legal system, you know, legal invisibility as well, of indigenous peoples. And that's why now we should speak, you know, about what indigenous peoples have actually achieved on the legal, on the legal level.
Exactly. Wow, that sets a real good context to talk about cultural heritage and, you know, the human rights and dignity. Exactly. And that's what we're striving for.
You know, again, I will answer these things as best I can by recalling the positions of indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples, when they started coming annually, regularly from 1982 to date, to the specific meetings that are for on indigenous peoples, but also others, because they go on for on environmental meetings, they go to climate change meetings and others, but mainly these human rights meetings. So from when they first came, they were not just demanding, you know, I want to say how their approach was one of morals. They wanted very much to keep the moral high ground. And I want to quote Kenneth Deere, the elder, the Mohawk elder. He lives on the Kanawage, on the Canadian side. And he has been there from the beginning. And he says, whenever he can take the floor on this, he says, never drop the moral high ground, he says to everybody, to the leaders, to the indigenous representative. So speaking of that, precisely indigenous peoples were, if I can use the word, introducing themselves, Angelina. They were speaking about who they are, what their systems of culture are, what their systems of governance are, and how linked they are to their philosophies. They spoke a lot about their philosophies. They were educating the non-Indigenous world, not just anthropologists who would visit them, you know, a couple of anthropologists, but now they had a huge audience, right? Mm-hmm. They had states, they had other non-governmental organizations, they had UN agencies, everybody, the world was there, right? So they were saying that, and that goes to cultural heritage, because one of the three pillars, as I call it, the three pillars, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples has three pillars: right to self-determination, right to lands, territories, and resources, and cultural rights. So they were always speaking about cultural heritage and rights and how this has to do deeply with their dignity. Of course, they were giving examples of how it was suppressed. For example, that their sacred sites were destroyed, or that when they would wear their traditional clothes, they would not be allowed, or the children with long hair, they would need to cut their hair, the boys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was very, for me, very revealing, and how smart, how it was not just smart and strategic, Angelina, it was deep quality of human quality in their interventions. They were saying to this world, we are very human, deeply human. Here is our dignity. Here is our culture. This is our name. For example, when we were discussing the issue of should we call this working group on indigenous populations? What indigenous? So we spoke about the word indigenous for some years, you know. And they were saying, in my language, they would take the floor from different parts of the world, different tribes. In my language, Inuit means human being. Nobody else would say the same. So, but then they were realizing and saying, since we have so many languages, we need to find a common word. Okay, let's use indigenous. And over the years and decades, because it took 25 years to draft the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the word indigenous peoples has now become a political international concept, an identity, beautiful, for which indigenous peoples are proud, right? And also a legal category, because now we have the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that tells us what this is. And one of the things it says is, and it has to do with self-determination and culture, it says that self-identification of it as indigenous, of the group as indigenous, is fundamental. It's not enough for somebody from outside to go and say, hey, you are wearing something like this, you must be indigenous. No, if I, depends on how I want, because this is also a political and legal concept. You know? And so self-identification that was approved at the United Nations was so important, you know, for self-determination of indigenous groups. But you see, what I am doing here in response to your question on cultural heritage, I am weaving the concepts because they are interlinked. For example, indigenous peoples have said, as for example, for us, land, they said, it's not just a material thing, which of course it is, because we need it to survive. But it's also a way for a spiritual part of our spiritual existence and our cultural existence as indigenous peoples. So you see how linked, you know, how everything is linked, culture and land and self-determination.
Absolutely. That's amazing because, well, I'm an indigenous person, and in my language, Dene Stupsene, Dene means people. You know, so that goes right with what you said. It validates, you know, what you said. And my father was a hunter-trapper and lived on the land. So it was our cultural expression to exercise those rights directly connected to the land. And it really makes sense that, you know, that becomes a big part of who we are, who he was, you know, and to this day, I mean, I've seen, you know, some of your speeches and you talk about, you know, the quest for self-determination and discrimination continues today. And on my dad's land, the traditional land, there are uranium companies proposing to explore and take out the uranium, which is extremely toxic for the environment. And, you know, and so some of my family members are poising to be activists against that. And it's really difficult because most Indigenous people don't have the funds to do activism. You know, they can do it just in bits and pieces. And that takes a long time, you know. And I think that's why internationally, you know, the UN, that forum is really important because it's the highest level that you can speak at to get recognition. And, you know, so while we're talking about that, in the early 70s, my brothers were part of the American Indian movement, you know, at Wounded Knee. They were at Wounded Knee. I was too young at that time to really understand what was going on. But they talk about it often as a badge of honor to protect, you know, their rights. Like this was the beginning for them to stand up against what was occurring, you know, on the land. And they always speak about it. You know, I actually had 10 brothers, and most of them were at Wounded Knee. You know, except for the younger ones, but my older brothers were there, and it's a huge pride to say they were members of the AIM movement at the time.
Yes, yes. And you know, I'm very glad you mentioned this family story, and it's not just family, you know, it's for the whole movement, Wounded Knee, because what you possibly experienced at home, in family, speaking about that, this spirit of resistance and inspiration and vision was brought to the UN conference rooms by the leaders. Mm-hmm. Because people who had been at Wounded Knee, of course they came. 1982, when the working group started, of course they came. Mm-hmm. You know, and they brought that spirit. And that's why, this is one of the reasons why that this became, you know, an international social movement that is steeped in concepts of justice, struggle, resistance, and vision for something better, you know, because Indigenous people that time, but also now they continue. And it's very, you know, inspiring to see the young leaders. Because they bring there another generation, of course, you know. They bring also new issues, but they continue, they speak this language. They have learned it, you know, the language that reflects the culture they come from, you know. And they learn from elders some things that the elders passed on, plus they add their own things, of course, you know. And I think this leads me to a very important point that Indigenous peoples, Indigenous leaders, they were trying to win hearts and minds at the international level. In other words, they were speaking to us as human beings and, of course, to our logical mind, strategic, political, whatever you want to call the other. But they wanted to win us over. And this mattered not so much for UN staff like I was, but especially for the representatives of states, because there were states there, and there still are, of course, that are very hard on things Indigenous, right? Mm-hmm. They are not easy. But if you win over these people in their heart and they understand that this is a very just cause, these people are really right, they are going, they have the power to give a tone to their speeches that is different, to send a recommendation to their foreign ministry, you know, mm-hmm. that is different, and to mend. For example, I will tell you, since you are in Canada, there were times in the politics of Canada where some governments were harsh on things indigenous, you know?
Still are.
Still are. Some are. And, you know, it changes a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah.
But anyway, there were some times where they were very hard. But we, for example, at the United Nations, in the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum, me, Elsa, as a diplomatically human rights thinking person, I didn't want to break relations with and stop speaking to the staff. The staff are, you know, career staff, public civil servants, you know. Mm. And if you keep that, and actually we managed to do some good things, and we managed to get Canada to fund some good things that we did at that time, mm. of the more difficult time. Meaning things are not black and white in politics, either nationally or internationally. And internationally, because you have to do with so many actors, you can use your ingenuity. I don't want to call it diplomacy because it's more than your ingenuity, your sense of humanity, you know, and open your tentacles, your antennas, and connect in ways that might not give a result today, but maybe in 5 years. And actually, Canada, you know, in recent times, just before COVID, because in COVID we stopped meeting personally, this year we'll be again fully in person, and we are all excited next week. But you know, Canada was coming in and making some wonderful announcements about the policy things that they were undertaking, and everybody was very happy to hear that. So in other words, there are the good moments and the bad moments. And when, during both times, you have to continue the struggle, because this is a long-term struggle. And I like very much to hear, you know, some of the first elders, you know, who went and started the movement in the 70s, who, when they, we are lucky to hear them on a panel, you know, they will say, what? In 40, 50 years, we have done all this. This is very fast that we managed all this. Mm-hmm. You know, they put the perspective of time, and they go into deep time, you know, from when it started, colonization, da-da-da. And look, since the 70s to date, look what we have. We have, you know, three indigenous-related human rights mechanisms. We have the International Labour Organization Convention 169. We have the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Two indigenous decades at the UN, right? Yeah. One International Year on Indigenous Languages, 2019. Yeah. Now we have a decade on Indigenous Languages that started 2022. And in 2014, we had the International Conference on Indigenous Peoples. These are very few movements, Angelina, can say that they have achieved all this. They have not. So it is a very life-affirming movement to be connected with, learning from. And I know that other social movements are trying to learn from it.
Mm, absolutely. Well, it's good that you mentioned this, you know, and a reminder, because often we feel that things are going slow, too slow. Like we need to be reminded about the progress that have been made in moving forward, you know. I actually worked with, you know, I met Tarsila through the Indigenous Women's of the Americas. And I remember doing some work with her on intellectual property of some of the indigenous women in the Americas, you know, in Colombia, in Peru, and just looking at safeguarding their intellectual property for the for the projects that they were doing. And this is really important to them because this is part of, as we said earlier, you know, the cultural heritage and how we recognize and affirm who we are through our ceremonies and customs, right? It's so important.
Exactly. And, you know, I just want to say that the social group in the world that has put the protection of in traditional knowledge and folklore, they call it, on the international arena, the indigenous peoples of the world. And many other communities will benefit from it once it is solved, but it has not been solved. What the indigenous peoples have been trying to do now, how many years ago it started? 15 years ago at the World Intellectual Property Organization. They have a working group to discuss this, traditional knowledge protection. And indigenous people go there, and what are they asking? They're saying, we have been so exploited, and we want this to stop. And what we want you to recognize, states, is that you need to recognize our own legal systems, which are based on our culture as well. Of course, it's legal pluralism, right? Because for centuries, we managed to preserve and protect our traditional knowledge through these systems. And we want to continue that. It has worked. So don't tell us just that we have to have your particular law when it comes to indigenous knowledge, you know, and not, it's a broad concept knowledge. It can be the arts, the cultivation system. It can be many things, you know, what we know about plants, etc., is ours, you know, and we want you to recognize our systems of protection. And they're stuck there. And a very, very difficult country to convince is the United States, and I'm sure Canada as well, you know. So, but I'm glad you mentioned this. There have been some good examples in this country also where indigenous peoples have fought at local and state level, for example, to drop names, for example, of sports teams that pick up indigenous names because indigenous people don't like that, and they have managed to drop them finally. Or there was, for example, I remember a demonstration in front of Zara, the big, you know, Zara, the big store, clothing store, because they had brought in beautiful blouses with embroidery. And I guess some indigenous women saw it, you know, and started demonstrations in New York City saying, this is from our community. Look, we are wearing it. Look, it's exactly the same. And they stopped it. Zara, you know, in other words, there are achievements also at that level, not necessarily global, but there are some achievements.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I see that, you know, it's evident, you know, when we look at some of the voices. I mean, for example, Idle No More in Canada was kind of a movement looking at just bringing voice, a collective voice. And it was quite strong. I haven't heard about that movement in recent months or even last few years. I don't know what happened to them, but they were really, really focused on Indigenous culture. Like they would show up and have these protests wearing, you know, cultural garment and singing and drumming and just bringing to the surface how unique we are, and I guess even just the what they call themselves, Idle No More. So in essence, they're saying we're not going to sit by and just let you know, this happened, we're going to stand up, we're going to show up, we're going to say something, right?
Yeah. And you know, Angelina, indigenous peoples have also used their culture vis-a-vis non-indigenous to make their point and to present themselves.
Yes.
And for example, when they will come to the UN, you know, there they will wear their traditional clothes, you know, to make a statement. And everybody, you know, at the UN, the staff, they say, wow, you know, this is the most diverse meeting we've ever seen. Because indigenous people also use it. But I wanted to say something because you mentioned the use of names and the resistance, etc. You know, Aveda, which is a big organization of beauty products, and it's part of Estée Lauder. So Aveda has a special relation, or wants to have and continues to weave a special relation to indigenous people. So at one point they had created a line called Indigenous.
Oh,
right. So we had just established the secretariat of the Permanent Forum in 2003, and their CEO, French gentleman, through some NGO intervention, wanted to get a meeting with us, with me and my colleagues, you know, and discuss about the name Indigenous in the beauty products. So I had to explain to him, you know, why this word, like I was saying before, this has become like a sacred word, a word, you know, it has to do with a very important and strong and long social movement for rights and dignity. So if you use this word, you didn't know, but if you use it for cream, a head cream, you belittle this. So I understand why people don't like it. Result, they stopped it. They withdrew it. I was very glad. These are small things, but I said to him, especially you guys in Aveda, you want to show a good face to the world in your collaboration with indigenous peoples?
Mm-hmm.
Drop this line. They dropped it. And they have continued some very good practices instead. Together with indigenous peoples in the Amazon, in Brazil, for example. I will not give you details. Perhaps we don't have enough time. But very positive and high-level relations with them, where the chief of the tribe will only accept to speak to the CEO of Aveda in Paris. It's chief to chief. That's it. So beautiful. I mean, we have beautiful examples, you know, that inspire us and which have to do the winning of hearts and minds, because yes, we have human philosophical achievements and legal achievements, and we use them in parallel, right? We use them all. Not only we use them, but we also celebrate.
I never knew that about Aveda, and I had used their products and I like it, but I've never heard of that particular product, and I'm pleased to hear that they dropped that their naming Indigenous on their product, because you're right, they know nothing about Indigenous peoples, and I don't know who they were consulting when they designed the marketing for that, you know, but it's great that they took that down. It's these small successes moving forward that we can, it's like stepping stones, right? Towards our goal is, you know, we just continue with that. Yeah. So we're getting, like, we've got about 20 minutes left. And what I want to do is just to continue with the context. And I want to ask you, I mean, it's fairly evident when I did the research on the UN and your contribution, what your legacy would be. But what I want to ask you is, when you're looking at your legacy, what can we do to what's yet to be done to continue to get our humanity of Indigenous peoples affirming with our culture and moving forward? How can we continue to build those stepping stones?
Oh, this is, yeah, this is the question, dear. This is the question. And it is a question that is valid both, of course, at national, local level and at international level. You know, like, it is a long-term fight. Like when we say, you know, for equality, when we fight for equality between the sexes, when we fight for to eliminate racial discrimination. These are long-term fights. I also believe that indeed the struggle of Indigenous peoples is a long-term struggle, because it brings in, you know, it has to do with some with the state of mind of the non-Indigenous, you know, who, and that mind has been educated, you know, through colonial practices, through privileges also. And privileges, as soon as you inform them and they understand the common person, right, that actually their well-being now is due to the fact that so much land and resources has been stolen from Indigenous peoples. This is something that creates, you know, the sense of guilt, and also people become defensive. They don't like that, to be told that. So, in other words, what I was saying, the changing of hearts and minds, you know, has to be done at many levels. But I also find that our fellow human beings, you know, are not, if I speak about the general social level, right? Yeah. They're not blind and deaf. If we approach them the right way, like, for example, my American family, because I'm married to an American, so I see, I have a mother-in-law and her friends, and I speak during the social gatherings and I say something about the Indigenous peoples, they listen. They haven't heard that ever. They don't know. You know, it's also how the system creates those minds, or the lack of education, or the positively bad education. So I think that both Indigenous peoples themselves and their allies or their friends, you know, in the, from the non-Indigenous world, we must continue these levels of awareness raising. And Angelina, I will tell you, one of the mandates of the Permanent Forum is awareness raising about Indigenous issues, because it is, it comes from the realization that there is not enough of it, both in the general public, but also in the public service, you know, on the state level, you know? Yeah. And so, for instance, one of the things that I would tell you now that we are at, for sure, is what we call training. We call training because, you know, if you tell the Ministry of Interior or some other, the Ministry of Justice, that you would like to change their minds about Indigenous peoples and you have to give them, you know, 3 days of that, they will not want, because they want to keep, you know, their pride. So you say training. I love this word because it is a word that, if you like, conceals a bit the aim, which is not just to share technical knowledge, but to make them deeply aware of the issue and give, of course, the technicals, because it is also very technical and it's also legal, everything, and teach them about that, you know, and then follow up. I think we need to do that. And we need to do that, I say, at three levels, you know, community. And by community, I mean the Indigenous communities should have, you know, some seminars together, community meetings about the rights of Indigenous peoples and the fantastic UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Then you need to inform/train the public service, right? The public service, the civil service. And that you cannot do, for example, in a country like Canada, a big important country, you cannot do it for all the ministries together. You know, you start with different. How will you do? Do you have the resources? You mentioned resources. Well, for this reason, you create alliances, collaborations. The indigenous the Mohawks, you know, Kahnawake, together with the University of Toronto, in collaboration with, I don't know, who else. You see?
Yeah.
So we create together a strength. That. And the third part that we have to train always are the internationals. Mm-hmm. I find that at the United Nations, where we have achieved fantastic policies also, UN policies for within the UN, for programs that the UN does. For example, that you have when you have an indigenous people's community, you have to deal with their governance structure, not Mr. So-and-so who happens to have learned a little English. No, that's not who represents that nation, right?
Right.
It has to be the representative. So we have to train, in other words, constantly the internationals, because the internationals, you know, when they set, they do their work, they can set a good example that the others then, whether state or other NGOs, they can set a good example, they can follow it, the others, or a bad example, and that will be very bad. If you have the UN doing a bad example of a project, and people say, hey, the UN did it this way, so we can do it.
Mm.
That's very bad for indigenous. So I think the awareness raising, but now it has to be much more focused. I also believe, you know, that different entities in our societies that have power socially, for example, churches, some churches are quite strong. It matters to get them to understand.
Yes.
Thing for real. For the same reason, you know, because when they do something bad, which I know we have examples, and we, you know, in Canada, we have read all this in recent times, we grieve.
Mm.
And at the same time, history, you know, a long time has passed, but we need to make them see much more how they can do it and why they should do it. And, you know, again, I will repeat, Angelina, that people, on whatever we do with indigenous peoples, let's remember the three pillars. We have to ask, what does it mean for the self-determination issue, rights of these indigenous people we are working with? What does it mean for lands, territories, and resources? What does it mean for cultural rights? So the 46 articles we have of the declaration are, you can say, they have clusters for each of these pillars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have to tell people that they have to do that and why, and convince them for real, you know? I see at the UN, I have to tell you this now, at the level of staff, I see much more openness to understand and to do things the right way. It is more at the level of staff, I'm saying the working people, but the leaderships, you know, who are like at ministerial level, these are the politicians, right, that we also have at the UN. This depends who they are. This depends what country they're from and from what political moment of that country they're coming from.
Absolutely. That's brilliant, because it's the politics changes depending on who's in charge. So you have that. And, you know, I want to bring it back to what you said about training. In Canada, we have, you know, we've been talking in the last few years about reconciliation and talking about, you know, the items of reconciliation from what Judge Sinclair had pulled out, and that is teaching. I remember when I was a university student, I used to speak at universities. And I remember one time I was sitting in the back of, I was in poli sci, and I was sitting in the back, and there was some students behind me, but I could smell their breath. It was really like they had been drinking, right? So it was a stuffy old building, and I could smell their breath. And then one of the guys behind me, one of the students, said, yeah, I hear that, you know, Indigenous students get all admitted to the university based on the fact that they're Indigenous. And I thought, well, that's a pretty racist statement. And so I said, you know, I'm an Indigenous person. And I didn't, when I applied to law, I didn't tick the box Indigenous. I wanted to make sure that I got in my own merit as a person, as a student. And I said, and I don't know any Indigenous person that has gotten into university that doesn't feel that they are benefiting, you know, by the education, because this is what they want to do. Because, you know, when the treaties were signed in my territory, Treaty 8, the chiefs were insistent that education be part of the agreement. You know, that was really important to them. And of course, on the other side, the government, you know, later on, you know, in the 1920s, when they established the Indian Act and residential schools, that was good for them because they wanted to assimilate us. And it was for a different reason, right? So, you know, my forefathers were looking at education because they knew that we needed to learn the language, learn the customs, so that we can put forward our needs and express what it is that we wanted from the government. And the government, they saw assimilation as taking away our Indigenous identity so that they can control us. And that was all about colonization. It's just to control who we were. And, you know, back to the story of the university student, it was really appalling because these young students behind me were speaking from a racist point of view, thinking that all Indigenous people were drunks or alcoholic and abusing, you know, the fact that they were admitted into the university when they themselves were doing it. Like these students behind me, I could smell the alcohol on them. And this was a morning class. And it was, I saw the hypocrisy, you know, like of how they were seeing Indigenous people when it was okay for them. Who knows, their parents might have been paying for their tuition and they were showing up to a lecture, you know, having had been drinking all night, I assume. But it just really goes to prove that education and training is really important, you know. And I know a number of my non-Indigenous friends, you know, for the longest time, well, it wasn't taught in the schools. Indigenous people's history wasn't taught in the schools. And it's since, you know, the conversation on reconciliation that we're now ensuring that it's in the curriculum and that people are learning about Indigenous people, not just from a historical perspective, but from today as people, right? We're not just in history. We exist today. And we're part of the social fabric today.
Exactly. This is exactly how I present my class to my students. I say, it's about today. We, of course, make some references, of course, historic, but it is about Indigenous people. And I want to tell you, and I finish because I think our time is up, but I was very inspired to learn, you know, that in 2019, British Columbia recognize the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as a framework for reconciliation, as it was called for by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And it means laws must get into alignment with the declaration, an action plan, annual reports, decision making together with indigenous people. You know, these are beautiful examples that we should make, we should learn from, we should, you know, publicize. It would be fantastic, for example, for me to hear an interview you could have with somebody from British Columbia who can speak about this, you know, what happened after 2019? How has this been evolved, implemented? You know, but these are beautiful things that we should learn about and, you know, expand and draw lessons from and inspiration.
Yeah. Well, it's really exciting that that's occurring. And it's just, you know, it's another stone on the step, you know, as we create this path of identifying and acknowledging we are just one society. I mean, there's many different societies, but we're part of the human society. And in that way, and I think so, you know, like with racism, it's because we look at them and us, right? Because we don't see the others as the same as us, that we feel we can denigrate them, you know, because they're not like us. And I know the Americans, you know, through Trump and his rhetoric, they buy into that. You know, it's always about them that are trying to cross the border. And he creates that division amongst people and denigrates, you know, people that are not him, white, middle-class white men, you know, and so, but I'm really, really so, you know, I've got so much gratitude for the fact that you accepted, you know, to speak to me this morning, and I've learned so much from you this morning, just in how much advancement that the UN has accomplished to date. And I'm so excited, you know, to see what in the future holds and how we're going to change, you know, the acceptance and more tools through the UN to create a lasting relationship with Indigenous peoples across the world.
Yes.
I'm really excited about that.
I agree totally with you. And I want to say, Angelina, the way we say goodbye often at the end of, for example, of the session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, we don't say goodbye with the friends. We say seguimos. We continue. So I want to say to you, and also in the spirit of our discussion, we continue, Angelina.
Beautiful. Yes. Yes, we will. And we will continue this relationship. And I had extended to you, if you're ever in Ottawa, to absolutely come visit. I drove to New York once. It's a 12-hour drive, but I've flown to New York and it's a 1-hour flight. But if you're ever thinking to come out this way, I'd love to host you and your family. It'd be wonderful to chat with you and share tea. It'd be great.
Yes, and the same with you if you come to New York, and you must come to the Permanent Forum if you haven't been.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been to the UN, just outside the UN, but never inside.
No, it's you need to have this experience, being that you are involved, it's part of who you are, because we also try in these meetings, we get encouragement to continue, you know,
yes.
Because that's where Indigenous peoples are there in numbers and strength. Mm-hmm. So they're not just three delegates in among 100.
Yes.
Are not Indigenous, you know,
right.
And they constantly fight. Of course, here they fight too, but it's different when we are many, many, many.
Yes. Yeah. Many can speak louder.
Very much yeah. So.
All right. So thank you so much for spending some time with me this morning. I really appreciate this conversation, and I'm hoping many people will listen to it and learn a few things. And, you know, the importance of the work of the UN and what's going on is really important.
end of the indigenous movement. It is very important.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Merci, Cho. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye. Bye. Bye, Angelina. Seguimos.
Yes, yes. Yeah, in my culture, in my language, we don't have a word for goodbye. You know, often when I'm speaking with my brothers on the phone, when we're done our conversation, I just hear click. And then I think, did I say something wrong? But yeah, we don't have a word.
Heard about it or read about it, actually.
Yeah. It's just like click. But I won't do that to you. So much. Thank you so much.
So long, dear.
Bye. All right. Bye-bye.